Welcome to Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Sam Tannenhaus. This week, a conversation with The Times' executive editor, Jill Abramson, about her new book, The Puppy Diaries.
I wondered when Scout came into our lives whether I could love her as much as I had loved Buddy.
Novelist Helen Shulman discusses This Beautiful Life, the selection on the Big City Book Club. Christopher Chabris talks about three new books on the science of the brain.
A lot of the things that Brain Bugs and some of these other books talk about are facts about the mind, about thinking and decision making, not necessarily about neurons and molecules and parts of the brain.
And Jennifer Schuessler has bestseller news. Jill Abramson is the executive editor of the New York Times. She's also an acclaimed and best-selling author. She's got a new book. It's called The Puppy Diaries, Raising a Dog Named Scout. It's reviewed for us this week by Alexandra Styron, who says Abramson has come up with a golden retriever of a memoir that should hit the wide heart-shaped mark cultivated by dog fanciers everywhere. I'm delighted that Jill's here to talk about her book. Welcome.
Thank you, Sam.
Okay, this is kind of a love story, and love stories are often about loss. So let's hear about the first dog, Buddy.
In the Puppy Diaries, I dwelled on the hard reality that as joyful and wonderful and exciting as it is to get a new puppy or welcome a new dog into your house, it invariably, if you've had prior dogs, it makes you think long and longingly at your first dog or your last dog. And that part was hard for me. I wondered when Scout came into our lives whether I could love her as much as I had loved Buddy, who was our first family dog and lived to be 16 years old and was an independently minded kind of little guy and the apple of my eye and occupied a big part of my heart. And no one really talks about that, but it was on my mind a lot.
And Jill, this is also a family memoir, too. Right? Buddy's the first dog, the Westie you all treasured.
Mm-hmm.
Your two children were young. He's a member of a different kind of family than your family had become.
Right, and I
Scout.
Spoiled him. There's no way around that. I would, sometimes guests would awake to the smell of my grilling some veal or chicken for him. I was a terrible doting person around Buddy, and The Puppy Diaries is in part a memoir about my family and the centrality of dogs in our lives as we grew up as a family.
And Jill, at first, after Buddy died, many of your friends, people in your family, said, get another dog. And you actually didn't want to do it. And what changed your mind?
I felt I wasn't ready. I was just so sad. But as someone who has a very busy career, it's striking how quickly you can adjust back to what I called sort of selfish living. Our kids were out of the nest at that point. They were young adults. And it became easy to organize my day just around my needs at work or my schedule with Henry, my husband, and not to have to race back to walk the dog or worry about has the dog been alone for too long. And I was torn between my heart not feeling ready to welcome another dog right away and a bit of selfish living.
Now, there's also a parallel story going on, which is that you had begun your career at the Times. You've been a journalist, accomplished journalist for many years, but you'd begun your career at the Times in the Washington Bureau. Then you came to New York to be managing editor,
mm-hmm.
of course, now the lead editor in the newsroom. But how did the change from Washington to New York affect the way you raised this young puppy?
Well, I was, Sam, a little bit reluctant to expose Scout to New York City. I thought the noise, the traffic might scare a little puppy. And Buddy had actually enjoyed living in New York, but he arrived here with me very late in his life. And I thought it would be both easier in the early training and more pleasurable for Scout to be in the country, and we got her in the summertime. But I learned from several dog behavior experts that it actually was a bad decision to wait a long time to expose Scout to New York, that the best thing to do is to socialize a dog really early with other animals and all kinds of people, different people, and that the city, in fact, probably was more jarring to her because we waited.
Speaking of the experts you consulted, this is a researched and investigated book. In some ways, that's what you
do. I don't
do.
Know if I would go that far.
Well, you spoke with Temple Grandin.
Yes,
for
I did, and with Cesar Millan, and I read a lot of current books on animal behavior, which is a very hot topic these days and one that interests a lot of people. I think of the puppy diaries as being part manual and part memoir.
Which raises another question about the writing of the book. Each of your books has had a larger story to tell than the one directly addressed in the narrative. Where They Are Now, which is about women graduates, Harvard Law School, 1974, was really about the pressures of highly educated, ambitious women entering a world dominated by men, the legal profession. And your prize-winning bestseller, Strange Justice, about Clarence Thomas, is really about the politicization of Supreme Court selection. This book is also about the transition to a new kind of journalism because it began as a blog.
Well, I didn't set out to write this story as a book. I did it as an online column on the New York Times website. And it was the first journalism that I did myself where I was exposed to a very vigorous and interesting back and forth with readers because dogs and pets are definitely a subject that people feel very passionately about. And the response to the column was immediate. It was quite positive. And, you know, I wrote it periodically. But as I went along, my idea was to chronicle Scout's first year, what both the rigors and delight of raising a puppy. And I ended up, you know, leaving a lot of things on the cutting room floor. There were very memorable characters who helped me when Scout was a new puppy, and I found myself feeling a little clueless on occasion. Other dog owners who we met and walked with every morning and every afternoon, and, you know, deep friendships and bonds were formed through that. And, you know, just there was a natural narrative at the point I finished with the 1 year and the column, and the idea of going back and trying to weave it into one story that flowed appealed to me a lot.
Well, and in some sense, Jill, that's the microcosm of what we're now doing at the New York Times. The world knows, as we're paying attention, that you're strongly committed to a newspaper that will integrate the web, the digital side,
right,
very closely with print. How much did this particular experience color your perception of where journalism should go?
Well, it colored it in that readers want it all, and they want it as soon as you can give it to them. They want to combine pictures and video, and they want to comment they want to talk to other dog owners. Our website crashed when I invited readers online to send in pictures of their dogs, and we made a photo quilt. We were just inundated with wonderful pictures from readers. That journalism is no longer simply the authority of an editor or reporter telling a passive audience what the facts are and what to think about them. It's more of a vigorous back and forth. And I think journalism is strengthened by that and all of the opportunity that the digital landscape offers us.
Thanks so much, Jill.
Thank you.
That's Jill Abramson, whose new book, The Puppy Diaries, Raising a Dog Named Scout, is reviewed in this week's book review. A few weeks ago, The Times began its Big City Book Club, hosted by columnist Genia Belafonte. Their current selection is Helen Schulman's novel, This Beautiful Life. Not long ago, Helen visited us to talk about her novel when it was reviewed on the cover of the book review. Helen Schulman is one of America's most accomplished and prolific novelists. Her new book is called This Beautiful Life. It's reviewed on our cover by Maria Russo, who says This Beautiful Life is a riveting narrative and that it fiercely inhabits our online reality even as it operates most powerfully on a deeper level, posing enduring questions about American values. I'm delighted that Helen's here to talk about her book. Welcome, Helen.
Thank you for having me.
Well, that's a lot to take on. We have a family in Manhattan, kind of upscale, but also living a highly pressurized life.
Absolutely. They've moved recently. They lived in a college town, Ithaca. The husband, Richard, came to take a job in a New York University, and his family followed reluctantly. And now the kids are in high-pressure private schools. It's a mother. His name is Liz. She was a art historian, and now she's a stay-at-home mom. They have a 15-and-a-half-year-old son, Jake, and a 5-year-old daughter, Coco.
Now, this is going to sound familiar to a lot of our listeners. These are the lives many people in New York lead. But serious things happen here that also feel as if they could happen to almost any parent in New York.
Yes, Jake has a big crush on a girl in his school named Audrey, and he goes to a party, and when he sees her go off with another boy, he hooks up with the hostess of the party. No parents are there. The girl's name is Daisy, and she's much younger. She's 13 and a half. Wow. And she's very sexually precocious. She's very desperate and emotionally needy. She's also oddly empowered. They hook up at the party, and when she wants him to spend the night, he kind of publicly humiliates her by saying, no, 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 you're too young. They're all drunk. They're teenagers. And he goes home. But when he gets home the next morning, when he wakes up, there's an email from her, and she has videotaped herself performing a sexual act to a Beyoncé song, Naughty Girl, and sent it to him saying, do you still think I'm too young? It's such a hot potato, he doesn't know what to do with it. He really is a nice kid. And he forwards it to his best friend, who then forwards it to two people. And by the end of the day, it's gone completely viral. And it's not only all over the city, it's all over the country and all over the world. And it just makes the whole community explode.
Helen, there's a story you're telling as well about the aspirations and ambitions of the parents and the life they've chosen for themselves. You live in Manhattan. You've got a couple of kids. Your husband, Bruce Handy, who writes for us all the time, a prominent writer and editor in New York. You are, too. Is this what's going on in our world today, things like this?
Well, I think things like this always happen, but not this way. I mean, kids always acted out. It's sort of their job as teenagers to do that. They're experimenting sexually, romantically, passionately. Having good judgment and waiting something out is not what it means to be a teenager. It's always been like that. What's different now is the internet. If a kid makes a mistake, you can't contain it. If a grown-up makes a mistake, if Anthony Weiner makes many, many hideous mistakes, they are uncontainable because the internet, at least at this point, doesn't forget. and it proliferates. And I don't think any of us really, kids or adults, are quite aware truly about that. You know, we all know it, but people continue to make the same errors. I think the other thing was I really was interested not just in the earthquake of the internet on the culture, but post 9/11 American culture. And growing up in New York, I grew up here, being here for 9/11 and then being here through the whole build up to the banking crisis and to the recession, I felt like being at ground zero again and watching all the excess. Also, the fact that people have big guns now. What might have been solved at another time by two fathers beating each other up at a baseball field is suddenly in the courts, in the court of public opinion, in the newspapers, on Gawker, online. And just sort of how big everything is now is maybe not in the best interest of these kids.
Helen, our reviewer Maria Russo praises you for many things, but she thinks one of the smartest decisions you made was to set the novel sometime after 9/11, 2003, I think, but before the implosion in Wall Street. So there's a distinct period in your mind. Was New York a particular kind of place just then?
Absolutely. I mean, that's why I did it. And what happens, you know, the father, Richard, in the story is very keenly interested in power. He's also interested in money, and he's also interested in doing good. And the tensions of all those things within him are very complicated, and they overwhelm him. You know, I grew up in the city, and my dad was a doctor. I had a nice middle-class life. I never quite saw the wealth and the greed that I saw when my kids were in private school and in the city, and saw a lot of nice, wealthy people, too. But I do think there was kind of this crazy, we're going to live for today feeling that followed 9/11, and it gave birth to a lot of excess.
Are some of these values or misbegotten values that define the world of adolescence now spring from their own particular world or their surrounding culture, or how much is actually being transmitted by their parents? How much are they, just as children have always been in some way, their parents' children?
Well, I mean, the parents in my book, I think, are too big for their own children. But I think that the culture, and it's not just this moneyed Manhattan culture, it's everywhere, is you do have the threat of the internet. You do have, you know, really sex roles was something I was really interested in, because I was, having grown up in the 70s in the time of feminism, you know, I just remember all my friends' mothers saying to us, you know, you girls have got to take care of yourselves. You have to have your own careers. You have to be independent. And then watching my daughter grow up, and I see all these women who are fortunate enough to have a choice about working or staying home, and a lot of them choosing to stay home for good reason, right? Because kids need parents, and they, you know, a lot of their husbands were working very, very hard and long hours, but giving up all the work that they had done towards getting various degrees and this great education, and finding that a lot of their power source was in their appearance and holding on to these men who were making a lot of money, you know. So that interested me. I felt like the pressures on young girls now are really different than when I was a kid. I mean, in some ways, it's gone backwards. You know, I remember trying to find bat mitzvah dresses for my daughter when she was going to those parties that didn't look like they were for prostitutes. You know, it was hard. So I think young girls are overly sexualized, and that really comes out in the book.
Thanks a lot, Helen.
Thank you.
That's Helen Shulman, whose new novel, This Beautiful Life, is reviewed on the cover of this week's book review. Neuroscience remains one of the exciting fields, scientific fields of research, and also one whose findings are often disputed. There are three new books reviewed in this week's book review. One is called Brain Bugs: How the Brain's Flaws Shape Our Lives. Another is called Now You See It: How the Brain Science of Attention Will Transform the Way We Live, Work, and Learn. The third is called The Compass of Pleasure: How Our Brains Make Fatty Foods, Orgasm, Exercise, Marijuana, Generosity, Vodka, Learning, and Gambling Feel So Good. They're reviewed for us by a great psychologist and psychology writer, Christopher Chabris, professor at Union College, and he's here to talk about them. Welcome, Chris.
Nice to be here.
All right, so let's work through these books one at a time. Let's start with Brain Bugs by Dean Bronomano. What's he telling us here?
Well, he's got a book about flaws in our mental architecture. And the book's called Brain Bugs, but it's really mostly about problems with the design of the mind that tend to lead us to make bad decisions, not be able to exercise self-control when we want to. And he describes these largely as resulting from the way memory works. So memory is sort of structured in an associative way. Whenever we think of one thing, we think of things that are related to it. This is useful because when we think about banks, we want to think about money. It's nice to be able to sort of think about the things that are related to things. But he talks about a lot of research that shows that these associations really flow from one domain of thinking, such as word puzzles, into completely different ones, such as how you behave towards other people. So merely unscrambling words about politeness, for example, can lead you to be more polite afterwards in a social encounter. And it's all these kinds of associations that really sort of lead us to do things we don't really suspect we're doing and to have our behavior manipulated in ways that we don't think it's being manipulated by our environments that get us into trouble, according to his argument.
How serious a book is this? How convincing are the arguments and the research behind them?
It's a serious book, and Bronomano is a neuroscientist, so he's a serious writer. He has the command of what he's talking about. I think one flaw in the book is he tends to present the results of all of these studies that he cites as though they must certainly be true and that there are no weaknesses in them and no flaws in those studies themselves. So he's a little bit too credulous sometimes on some of this research. A lot of the studies he talks about are classics, but some of the newer ones really haven't been repeated by other researchers, or at least not very often. And the interpretations he puts on them are not necessarily always correct. It's a little bit surprising that in this book, it's called Brain Bugs. But a lot of what he talks about is really about how the mind works. And that's sort of a trend in all of these books. We use the word brain often nowadays when what we're really talking about is what we used to call the mind, thinking processes, emotions, decision making. The brain doesn't really play a huge role in some of these books.
So is the difference between the mind, as most of us would think of, and the actual circuitry of the brain, is that what's not being discussed so much here?
Yes, there's a tendency to just use the word brain to refer to anything that's going on inside the head. I guess it's sexier. People think it sells more books. Maybe it sounds more modern, high-tech. It sounds like a deeper explanation maybe of our behavior to talk about the brain than to talk about the mind. But in fact, a lot of the things that Brain Bugs and some of these other books talk about are facts about the mind, about thinking and decision making, not necessarily about neurons and molecules and parts of the brain with direct evidence from those kinds of – from the kind of science that really tells us about those parts of the brain.
Well, now that you've raised the question of the brain versus the mind and how much science we're really looking at, how about Kathy Davidson's book, Now You See It? You're pretty tough on that one.
Well, I think it's a really interesting book, and it's an ambitious book. So Kathy Davidson, who's a professor at Duke, tries to use some research about attention and other things about the brain to really make a sweeping argument that our whole education system needs to be overhauled from top to bottom, and also that a lot of the ways we do business and the ways we live our lives should change to reflect new understandings about attention and how the brain works.
Let's start with the educational system. What evidence does she cite? What are the reasons she gives for changing it? What's she looking at, the internet or Google? Or what's the kind of anecdotal story she's telling here?
The idea is that current educational practices are really sort of industrial age, almost Victorian practices of putting people in schoolrooms, large numbers of people, giving them lots of tests, drilling, old-fashioned practices. She says the whole design of schools is oriented towards this. You've got all desks in a row and so on. It's not an unfamiliar argument. What she brings in that's new is the argument that the internet is really changing intellectual life and changing the way kids growing up today process information and respond to the world so much that we have to change the educational system in response. And in fact, we should adopt in the educational system practices that are sort of common on the internet. For example, crowdsourcing of grades. One of her most famous arguments is that grading would be just as well done and maybe more educational if the students did the grading themselves. And of course, that takes a little pressure off the teacher, I suppose, as well. But the fact that crowdsourcing reviews maybe on the internet, like on Amazon, you know, works well and lets people express their opinions of works doesn't mean that that's the right way to evaluate students and to see whether they're making progress and perhaps achieving standards that we should legitimately want them to achieve.
Now, what about The Compass of Pleasure by David Linden with that hugely long subtitle that takes us from orgasm to vodka and fatty foods?
Well, in fact, he really does talk about all those things. It's not just a laundry list. It is a laundry list title, but it really does reflect what's in the book. And the fact that all those things are on the same list is really indicative of Linden's key point, which is that there's one circuit in the brain. And this is a book which actually does talk about the brain and real brain science and real brain experiments. There's one circuit in the brain that accounts for the fact that we find all of those different things at different times pleasurable. So when we find something pleasurable and when it motivates us to make choices, such as cocaine motivating an addict to do some crazy things in order to get more cocaine, or food motivating us to eat it, it's all because of the workings of this one circuit called the reward circuit, which uses the neurotransmitter dopamine. So we're all familiar with sort of the idea of dopamine as a pleasure chemical. Well, this is the book that really explains how that whole system in the brain works, why all these different things use that same system, and talks about some really interesting research now about how even units of information, for humans, these would be, you know, tweets or Facebook photos or blog posts or something like that, activate that same circuit. He doesn't have evidence that tweets activate the reward circuit, but in some animal experiments, just learning small amounts of information about what's going to happen next in the animal's life caused that circuit to respond. So information by itself can be a reward, according to Linden's argument. And I think that has a lot of implications for how we view internet addiction or whether the internet is really changing our brains or the relationship between the internet and education, in fact.
You are a researcher yourself. In fact, some of your experiments, I think, are cited in some of these books. Is research being conducted differently now from how it was, say, before the internet, 10 or 15 or 20 years ago?
The internet has actually affected scientific research a lot. I can think of at least two ways that come to mind right now. First, it makes collaboration a lot easier. So I can't tell you how many times I have conference calls with groups of three, four, five other researchers from different parts of the country, different parts of the world. That would not have happened 10, 15 years ago. It would have been prohibitively expensive or impossible, or you just wouldn't have met those people in the first place if it weren't so easy to communicate with so many people. That's one way. Another way is you can actually conduct research on the internet. These books don't really talk about that too much, but it's definitely a coming trend to actually collect your data on the internet. You don't need to bring people into your laboratory to do social science research anymore. You can test them online, and those methods actually work fairly well.
Thanks so much, Chris. That's Christopher Chabers, who this week reviews three books on the mind or the brain. Jennifer Schuessler is here with Bestseller News. Hi, Jenny.
Hi, Sam.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, we do have a new book on top of the fiction list. It is John Sanford's latest thriller. It is called Shockwave. He knocks off Lee Child, who only had 1 week in the top spot with his latest, The Affair. In more literary precincts, we do have two sort of literary novels on the list this week, unusually. Alice Hoffman, sort of a perennial bestseller, has a new book on the list. It is called Dove Keepers, and it is a historical novel set during the siege of Masada in ancient Israel. It is at number 11. Chad Harbach.
The baseball guy.
Yeah, one of the sort of most ballyhooed literary debuts of the season, The Art of Fielding. It is hanging on at number 15 in its fifth week. We will see if he can make it through to the World Series.
Unlike the Yankees, I'm a Mets fan. What about nonfiction?
Bill O'Reilly and Martin Nugard still on top with their book Killing Lincoln, which is about, you guessed it, the assassination of Lincoln. But we do have a bunch of new books. Michael Lewis is back with a book called Boomerang. It's at number 2. It's a collection of pieces from Greece, Ireland, Iceland, other sort of disaster zones in our unfolding global economic meltdown.
Right. They ran in Vanity Fair. At least a number of them did.
Yes, yes. Great pieces. And Ellen DeGeneres, also a collection of more amusing pieces, although Michael Lewis is pretty funny. Her book is called Seriously, I'm Kidding. It lands at number 3. But the man of the hour, Herman Cain, is on the list at number 4 with his book. It is called, in case there's any doubt, This is Herman Cain! Exclamation point. I don't quite know how to do a dramatic reading of this title. My Journey to the White House, and it enters at number 4.
Well, some are saying that he's putting more energy into promoting this book than he is to presenting policy, though he does have his 999 idea.
That's true. Well, you know, it may well be that the road to the White House does run right through Barnes & Noble, although you can look at Sarah Palin. She had quite a run out on a book tour, and, you know, she's not even in the race. Formally declared her non-candidacy. But the thing that's interesting, yeah, there have been a bunch of stories that have run in recent days about Kane sort of neglecting his formal campaign duties, sort of neglecting to kiss babies and instead spending a lot of time signing books. But it seems to be working for him. He is surging in the polls. A couple of polls released this week showed him, you know, tied with Romney in Virginia, gaining on Romney in New Hampshire. And then the latest national poll I just saw shows him actually slightly ahead of Romney. So, and, you know, I might as well give him the microphone here. A reporter apparently asked him if he was the flavor of the month, the latest Republican flavor of the month, and he said, you know, just call me black walnut since it tastes good all the time.
Wow. Thanks a lot, Jenny.
Thanks, Sam.
Thanks for listening. And remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. You can tell us what you think of this show or any New York Times podcast by emailing podcasts@nytimes.com. I'm Sam Tannenhaus.